Yo hablo inglés, un poco francés, muy poco ruso y muy, muy poco alemán, pero no catalán y no español. Perdón. Thank you very much for having me here. It's my first visit to Spain and to Barcelona. I first want to convey my condolences for the loss of lives and loves during the explosion in Madrid. The words, "I'm sorry for your pain," can never, never be enough, yet it is the truth, and I think it's important to say those words. Thank you for having me speak as a guest at Stitch and Split. Conceptually, it's an extremely intriguing event. It's exciting to be here in Spain. This space brings together the conceptual and the real. How can we think about our bodies, our actions, our science, our technology in the world, and how do we transform those thoughts into deeds? It probably says in the program book that I'm going to do readings and then comment on the readings, but I've ended up doing the reverse, where I've got comments and I'm using the readings to comment on my comments. There are many definitions of science fiction and fantasy. We argue about it a lot at science fiction conventions, and I've come up with my own. And it will change, but I currently think that science fiction, as a literature, examines the fact that human beings are tool makers and users. We are always altering our environments and ourselves and then having to deal with the consequences of the profound changes, both individual and systemic, that we've just wrought. This is a very real dilemma in the world. We see it being illustrated most urgently in recent events. So far from being escapist for me, science fiction imagines possibilities for where we want to go. Walter Mosley, a black writer from America who is better known for his mysteries, is also a science fiction reader and writer. And he has said that human beings, imagine what we want to do so that we can figure out how to do it. And that, for me, is one of the things that science fiction does. The tools that human beings create might be concrete. For instance, a technology as ancient as that by which we create vessels out of clay. Or they may be as modern as that by which we perform gender reassignment surgery. Being able to have more or less durable vessels in which to store and carry perishable items revolutionized human life. Similarly, as gender becomes more mutable, it calls into question practices that we as beings have sometimes reified in law based on our notion that gender is fixed. What we call hard science fiction talks about what this kind of change, technology-based change, does to our societies and to our persons. That is, of course, a generalization, and you can always find exceptions. The tools that human beings create might be intangible. For instance, when enslaved Africans with different communities, languages, customs, and beliefs were thrown together in the crucible of the slave trade and forbidden to speak their own languages, live according to their own cultural norms, or practice their own religions, they committed multiple clandestine acts of community building and resistance that resulted, among other innovations, in new and vital religious forms. When the woman king, and I call her king deliberately, she was not called a queen, when the woman king Njinga of Angola in Africa was trying to hold the Portuguese with their superior weapons technology at bay, she came up with practices of guerrilla warfare for her armies that enabled her to do so for nearly a decade and a half. Fantasy and soft science fiction examine how we act as a result of our beliefs and our cultural and social norms and practices. In a world that is and always has been ripe for change, these two genres talk about how change, both good and bad, happens. Science fiction is not really in the business of predicting the future. It's more that it starts from the premise that change is possible and even inevitable. We have no way of knowing what those changes will be, but we can examine the processes of change. I've joked before that I'm a fat black woman from a third world country, and as far as I'm concerned, the world needs to change in order that I and people in similar situations not go crazy. So for me, the literature of science fiction, even when it is grim, is essentially a hopeful one, because it does affirm that things can change in small ways and large. And yet, for all its openness, Science fiction is a literature that is still largely white, Western, and male-dominated, even though we live in a world where non-Western people of color are by far the majority. My friend, writer Ian Hageman, has said that when he reads a science fiction future in which all the human beings are white, he wonders when the race war happened that changed the world so drastically, and why the writer hasn't seen fit to mention it. Science fiction itself is a system that is ripe for change. What I'm doing here is I've taken a number of different talks that I have given at different times and taken ideas from them and pulled them together. So that I don't go on and on for an hour and a half, I'm going to be culling. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the use of language, specifically the use of Creole in my novel, Ladrón de Medianoche. And I'm not sure how it translated. This is in Spanish, or it's in Spanish. I'm not quite sure how it translated. But what I did, I'll talk a little bit about what I did. Midnight Robber allowed me to imagine a world rooted in Caribbean culture and folklore, in particular the Trinidad Carnival. So it takes that meme of science fiction and sets it in a different culture, but centers it within that culture. It's about a little girl living on her home world who gets yanked hither and yon between her parents as they carry on a hugely troubled relationship. Stories of her adventures become mixed up in the oral folklore of the culture. The central theme of the novel is the Midnight Robber, a classical masquerade from the Trinidad Carnival. A man dressed in exaggerated, outlandish bandit costumes would waylay people in the street on Carnival Day, for all I know they still do this, and regale them with a speech he'd written, a stream of consciousness fabulation about how he was the son of an African king who had been stolen away into slavery and escaped, of how he'd risked life and limb in terrifying adventures far from his home until he'd become a bandit to survive. It's a powerful metaphor for exile and longing for home, and it strongly references the Caribbean history of the African slave trade. The little girl in the novel identifies very much with the Midnight Robber mass. Part of what I set out to do was to imagine what paradigms for technology a society might develop without the all-pervasive influence of American technology and the way it references Greek and Roman mythology. For instance, we talk about the Apollo missions. We've named planets after Greek and Roman gods. We call our cities metropolises. But a diasporic Caribbean culture might name its computer operating systems after a West African deity with the power to go anywhere, see anything, issue. This culture's concepts of stewardship of its planet might be based in Taino values, the Tainos being the indigenous people who were living in the Caribbean when Columbus stumbled on that part of the world. I was also experimenting with the complex set of codes that are Caribbean Creoles. I know one pretty well, and bits of two others. Caribbean cultures are hybrid cultures. Hybridity was a strategy for survival and resistance amongst the enslaved and indentured people. They all came, as I said, from different cultures with different languages and then had an alien culture and speech imposed on them. It's a perfect metaphor for science fiction. They had to find ways to use elements of all the cultures in order to continue to exist. That hybridity is reflected in the languaging that Caribbean people have created. And I've tried to reflect that in Midnight Robber, largely in the ways that the characters use language when they speak, but also in the language of the narrative. I tried to write the book as it might be written if it were actually an artifact of the fictional culture I created. She ain't want to go down in the gully is standard English for them. So is she didn't want to go down in that gully. They code switch. They can decide whether they're going to speak formally or informally, as we all do. I've got a section from the opening page of Midnight Robber somewhere here. Here we go. I'll read you a brief. This is the introduction to Midnight Robber. Awo, like it start, inwi. Don't be frightened, sweetness is for the best. I go be with you the whole time. Trust me, and let me distract you with one little Anansi story. It had a woman, you see, a strong, hard back woman with skin like cocoa tea. She 2 foot them tough from hiking through the Diablo bush, the devil bush on the prison planet of New Halfway Tree. When she walk, She foot strike the hard earth book like breadfruit drop into the ground. She two arms hard with muscle from all the years of hacking paths through the diablo bush on new halfway tree. Even she hair itself rough and wiry. Long black natty locks springing from she scalp and coke, screwing all the way down she back. She named Tan Tan. And new halfway tree was she planet. Yes, this was a hard woman, we. The only thing soft about Tan Tan is she big molasses brown eyes that could look on you and your heart would start to beat time bubble ups with every flutter of she long eyelashes. One look in she eyes and you fall for she already. She had a way to screw them up small, small, like if she angry just so nobody wouldn't get lost in the melting brown of them, but it never worked, you hear? Once this woman eyes hold you, it'll have no other woman in the world for you. From Garvey Prime to Douglas Sector, from Toussaint, through the dimension veils to New Halfway Tree, she leave a trail of sad, lonely men, and women too, we, who would weep for days if you only make the mistake and say the words, wrong eyes. I'm going to stop translation there, rather than go on. Stop the reading there, transliteration. So the stylistic choices I made are quirky, much to the patient annoyance of my long-suffering writing group. They can seem inconsistent, they aren't really, but I had to write it to discover that. I realized after a while that I was using a Trinidadian mode of address for emphasis and irony, a Jamaican mode of address to signal opposition, and that came at least in part out of my recognition of the ways that Rastafari religion has created dread talk as a language of resistance. I'm fascinated with the notion of breaking an imposed language apart and remixing it. To speak in the hacked language is not just to speak in an accent or a creole. To say the words aloud is an act of referencing history and claiming space. The people of the nation worlds in my novel have done that, have left Earth to a place where they can make their own society. Their speech, written and spoken, reflects the reasons they've made that journey. Hence, Stolen Song, the poem that starts off Midnight Robber and that is written by my friend David Findlay. Linguists have a term for the way I've used language in the narrative. It's called code sliding. As I said, Caribbean speech has different modes of address. Speakers may choose to use different modes within a sentence, flipping from a relatively standard English, French, or Spanish to a more creolized form to a deep creole. All languages do this, but for some reason, it seems to be more an issue with Caribbean language. It infuses meaning into the language that goes beyond its context. Caribbean writers have been writing in fluid modes of address for years, so I had something to draw on when I did this. I was also referencing, science fiction has done this with novels like Ridley Walker, where the writer invents a form of language use. But in the Caribbean, as I said, it's a lived thing and it's something that Caribbean writers have been doing for a long time. In 1986, Samuel Selvin, who is the author of The Lonely Londoners and A Brighter Sun, told writer Frank Birbal Singh how he had stalled repeatedly when writing The Lonely Londoners until he began to write in what he called Caribbean language. Sometimes the text needed the poetic rhythms of Trinidadian stylings, sometimes those of standard English. When he used what seemed to suit each situation best, the work flowed. So I had the work of writers who'd gone before me to draw on as I was doing this. A question I hear a lot is, but why don't more people of color write speculative fiction, which is one of the terms for science fiction? We do, but it's unlikely that you'll find it on the shelves in your science fiction bookstores. Novels such as Gloria Naylor's Mama Day or Devorah Major's An Open Weave end up on the shelves for black authors, not in the science fiction section. And although magic realist writing contains fantastical elements, many do not think of it when they think of speculative fiction. And it's easier to find magic realism by authors of color than it is to find hard science fiction or genre fantasy. For ideas on why that may be so, you might read, as I did, Upinder Mahan's essay, The Domestication of Technology in Indian Science Fiction Short Stories, in a journal called Foundation, fall 1998. Mahan's essay is specifically about science fiction by writers from India, but a lot of what he says is applicable generally to science fiction by authors of color or to authors from non-Western cultures. And here's a quote from Upinder's essay. A significant factor is the lack of cultural intimacy between reader and writer. The reader of science fiction from another culture has to thoroughly understand the culture of the story, because he or she now has to understand not only the culture, but also the sometimes subtle deformations introduced into the culture through extrapolation. I run into that problem myself as a writer. My history and background combine Canadian, Trinidadian, Jamaican, and Guyanese cultures. Culture is no one monolithic thing for me, and I draw on that varied heritage when I write. But if I introduce a Sugoyan into a story, perhaps only readers from the Eastern Caribbean will know what that is. If I instead say succubus, I lose some readers' comprehension and gain others, and I haven't quite described the creature that I'm talking about. If I write vampire, chances are that pretty much everyone would have some idea of the kind of creature I mean. Through the weight of books and films generated by the SF industry, vampires are more familiar to more people than Sugoyans. But because I want to write about specifically a Sugoyan, which is neither a succubus nor a vampire, but has characteristics common to both, I have to spend time describing the being, its appearance, its habits, the mythology that spawned it. I risk boring a small segment of informed readers who are hopefully impatient to have me get on with the story. Or I can leave out the explanation and frustrate a larger group of readers who haven't a clue what I'm talking about. If I make my Sugoyan male or an infant, only informed readers will know how that departs from the myth as it exists in much of the Caribbean. They will understand that I'm generating an extrapolation that is one more removed from the existing lore, but to everyone else, a baby Sugoyan is just as remarkable as a grown one. They won't know that I've just made the impossible even more so. And I wrote this a few years before I discovered that the Juka people from Guyana have Sugoyans in more than one gender. This is a series of choices I have to make every time I write, weighing speculation against information. So I know what Mahan means when he talks about Indian science fiction writers battling the difficulty of living with a double consciousness, and conversely, the impossibility of living without hybridity. Even in how I describe my human characters, it's a decision I always have to make. I had a fellow writer say to me once that I had written a story in which about 4 pages in, I decided I needed to describe my character, and she was alone in a room. So I had her run her hand through what I described as her short natural. And someone in the critique group said her short natural what? Whereas to me, a natural means a short afro. And another person in the critique group said, well, I assume that characters in a story are white until I'm told differently. And she expects to know ahead of time. Whereas to me, this is just information that you put in or not as it's relevant, but I have to make the decision, whereas many of my fellow writers don't. Haphazardly creating my own personal library of fantastical writing by authors of color, particularly those of African descent. Some years ago, not some months ago, I went into a Canadian science fiction bookstore, and for anybody who might be from Canada or Toronto, it was not Baca. I was looking for the novel Green Grass, Running Water by Canadian First Nations writer Thomas King. The woman behind the counter said that she had read the novel and it was wonderful, but did I understand what kind of bookstore I was in? They didn't carry it. And I said, yes, I did know what kind of bookstore I was in, biting back the urge I sometimes have to say, I may not look like it, but I write the stuff. I do know what science fiction is. Now, I'm not sure if I have a section from Green Grass, Running Water here. No, I don't. It's a wonderful, wonderful novel, and it opens with the great god trying to create the earth, and Coyote steps in. And great god is using word to try to create the universe, and Coyote can't spell, so he gets god backwards and spells a dog and creates a dog instead, and hell goes to handcart, and everything goes to hell in a handcart thereafter. Green Grass, Running Water is magic realism. Admittedly, not what is called genre science fiction, but fantastical writing nevertheless. The same bookstore that saw no reason to carry it was stocked with novels by Tim Powers, whose work is also magical realism. The difference is one of positioning. Tim's publishers aim his work at science fiction markets. King's publishers put his work out and leave it up to people who love fiction to find it. So I'm not necessarily blaming the bookstore for an informed judgment about what their customers might be likely to buy. Arguments about the merits of literary fiction over genre fiction wax bitter. They also collapse under examination, but I'm not going to enter into the fray here. What I'm going to do is, having already read something that is more or less genre science fiction from my own work, I now have a section from another work that you will not find in the science fiction bookstores, Bone People by Kerry Hulme. Kerry Hulme is a New Zealand writer. I believe she's part Maori, but I'm not sure. This was her first novel. He is swimming down a foul, mud-colored river. Not really swimming. The water gets so shallow that he can pull himself along, hands walking on the river bottom. He knows he must not get his hair wet by the foulness, but already the long strands at the back of his neck are contaminated, and he is horrified corruption has touched him. He paddles and hand walks along, head reared high out of the water. Immediately in front of him is a very low bridge. He has no choice but to lower his head into the stinking stream. Retching, he slides down. Water creeps into his mouth, and to his surprise, it is sweet. Ahead, weeping willows, foreigners, trail into the water. The stream narrows until he has to stand up, for he can no longer float. The water trickles over his feet, sparkling and ice clear now. He looks down at Hannah, who lies on her back, smiling up at him, her face relaxed and full of joy. The stream flows from her vagina in a steady, pure rivulet. Eh, honey, I thought you were asleep. Joe, why would I sleep? It's time to feed Timoteo, eh? She shakes her head from side to side, and amidst her thick, long hair, he sees his little son moving his toes back and forward with his fingers as though to find out how far they'll go. He smiles gravely at Joe, but goes on playing, absorbed in these mobile toes. He lies down beside Hannah, stroking her forehead softly. The grass beneath his hips is warm and dry and prickly, but the sensation is not uncomfortable. Eh, Hannah, he says, beginning to breathe more quickly. Eh, takuhine. Hannah reaches for his hands and brings them to her lips. She kisses them. She says, well, Joe, my love, you'd better feed first, then. Her breasts before him are still swollen with milk. The milk is sweeter than the river water. Timoteo crawls out of the soft deeps of Hannah's hair and falls asleep near Hannah's other breast. A hand strokes his hair, a small, pale, crooked hand. Says Haimona. Aye, says Hannah to him, her face sleepy now but still calm. You suck by Timoteo, Mahimi, my heart child, my honey. But as the boy begins to drink, Hannah's face changes. Her skin goes gray and begins to run with sweat. Oh, the moths! The moths! She cries out, and her voice is harsh with terror. To his horror, he discovers he is sucking the fat, furred end of an enormous moth. So one of the reasons that fantasy gets configured as a different genre from magic realism, this is fairly clearly a dream or a hallucination of some kind. In fantasy, the story cannot be solved by she woke up and it was all a dream. Someone, other people have to witness the fantastical manifestations. And yet, as I said, as far as I'm concerned, they are both in their way using our imaginative imagery to tell a story. If I include non-genre fantastical writing in my collection, there are more works of speculative fiction and fantasy by authors of color than I have shelves to house them. Black artists in particular tend to go far outside the boundaries of mere text in creating science fictional worlds. Black expressions of the future happen in visual arts, in music, in media, in digital art, you name it. Jeffrey A. Tucker wrote his dissertation about the work of Samuel R. Delaney. He has a short essay online about the significance of Delaney's work. It's called Racial Realities and Amazing Alternatives, Studying the Works of Samuel R. Delaney. I like Tucker's notion that Delaney's work is a postmodern intervention into science fiction. When I first read Delaney's novel Dahlgren, I have said to others and to him that the person that finished reading it was a very different person from the one who started. That novel hacked my brain. There were concepts in it that had never occurred to me. There was a positioning that had never occurred to me. I mean, the story was being told by a very unreliable narrator, someone who's poor, homeless, insane, and of color, and queer. These were not things I'd seen put together in a novel and put in the point of view of the narrator. Colonizing other places is a central myth of science fiction, and one which has been explored with varying depths of criticality, from none to much. I wonder if the field might not be ripe for a post-colonial approach to writing. I love this. I wrote that in 1998. At the close of Octavia Butler's novel, Parable of the Talents, the black protagonist expresses her dismay that the first generation ship to go to the stars, through work that she has done, has been named the Christopher Columbus. For her, this name evokes the specter of colonization as Holocaust. Cultures which are clambering free of that particular legacy of colonialism will likely have a different take on science fiction's central myth. So I said I wrote that in 1998. I've just turned in a manuscript for a new anthology. It's a project to which Upinder Mahan, who wrote about Indian writers writing science fiction, invited me to be co-editor with him. The anthology is called So Long Been Dreaming, Post-Colonial Visions of the Future. Finally. It has been... I'm not sure where that line got in there. Apologies to the translators. In his statement at the end of the anthology, Dr. Mahan says, "Post-colonial writing has, for the most part, been intensely focused on examining contemporary reality as a legacy of a crippling colonial past, but rarely has it pondered that strange land of the future. Visions of the future imagine how life might be otherwise. If we do not imagine our futures, post-colonial peoples risk being condemned to be spoken about and for again." That was Upinder's vision, to create a vehicle in which English-speaking post-colonial writers of color could speak to our visions of the future or futures. To the best of my knowledge, it hasn't been done before. In 1998, I said that it should, and so we just went out and did it ourselves. The wonderful thing about science fiction is that for all its pervasive whiteness, it encourages new views of the world. I know that many science fiction readers will be at least eager to read the anthology, whatever they may end up thinking about it. They'll be eager to learn about some new writers. They'll be eager to hear and see a thing that they haven't seen before. And that is another reason why I write in this genre. Science fiction has reinvented itself repeatedly at the hands of the new wave, feminist, cyberpunk, and queer writers. Perhaps idealistically, I keep believing that it will keep opening itself up to fantastical expressions from communities of color and from other communities who have not been represented in it so far. How am I doing for time? What time is it? Time is it? Okay. I have one more thing that I have been thinking about. 15 minutes? Okay, that should do it. Yes. It'll be one more. Momentito. I've lost all my pieces of paper. Ah, voila. So, I also like to think about comics, because so often comics also are a form of science fiction and fantasy. And I went into a comics bookstore a few years ago and was talking to the owner. And he very earnestly explained to me that comics was a colorblind medium, and that's why I couldn't find the comics that were by artists of color. And he said that with the air of someone who's thought long and hard about the issue. The coda to that is I had gone in with two other black people, and we proceeded to go through the store and pick out the comics that were by black writers and black artists. And he didn't know how we could tell. I can't say that I was an avid comics reader as a child, but I certainly did like comics a lot, and I read them whenever I could get my hands on them. When I was living in Guyana in South America, when I was 16, with my Aunt Barbara, who was my father's half-brother's ex-wife, she had a son, handsome cousin Mark, my cousin, and he had boxes full of Mad Magazine and Eerie and Vampirella and Plop. And I read those. And for years, I don't know if Vampirella got here, but I suspect she did. Vampirella was my gold standard of what a woman's breasts should do if you slapped a strip of leather 4 inches wide over each of them and had her run and leap and tumble. But I'm getting over the body dysphoria now. But in retrospect, I think it's very clear why a little middle-class black Caribbean girl living in the tropical countries of Jamaica, Trinidad, and Guyana would be drawn to the Marvel and DC universes. I mean, just look at the Submariner, for instance. He wears swim trunks. He comes from a place surrounded by water. He speaks with an accent different from those of the other superheroes. He has features different from theirs and darker skin. Obviously, this man comes from the Caribbean. I know how to spot my people. It got more complicated with Daredevil. I knew that when he took his red tights off, he was a white American. But while he was in Daredevil drag, I, as a child, was subconsciously reading him as a black man, and for reasons I now find very troubling. When he was Daredevil, the skin of his suit was colored. He was all about physique and physical action, and he was a mischief maker, caused trouble wherever he went. Had to be a black man, right? It was decades before I was able to identify my child's absorbed and unspoken internalized racism on the topic, and could understand that the blackness I was reading as codified into Daredevil was a mythical conception of male blackness imposed from outside black realities. In many ways, comic books that hadn't been and still largely aren't written with people like me in mind, began my education into the politics of difference. There were other differences too. Remember the Fantastic Four, Reed Richards, the stretchy, clever scientist guy, his brother-in-law Johnny, the human flame, Ben, the powerful, wise-cracking thing made out of what appeared to be red brick, and Mrs. Sue Richards, Reed's wife. Okay, so you had the Fantastic Four, three cool guys who could do neat stuff, and a woman. And what was her superpower? She could disappear. What else would you expect a good 50s wife and mother to do? While the guys were flying around beating up and immobilizing the bad guys, she'd literally have gone invisible. The men would be going flack and pow, and she'd be invisible, whimpering, "Oh my, Reed, oh, oh." I was a muscular, big child with a decided lack of aptitude for invisibility. I didn't have perfectly upturned blonde hair, and I wasn't anybody's missus. I may have been 10 years old. That unimaginably daunting future that I was told awaited me, the inevitable one of becoming wife and mother, was one I knew I could put off thinking about for a very long time. I wanted fantasies of personal power, not of disappearing. So naturally, I identified with the thing. Many women and girls did and do this as we search the received wisdom of popular culture, looking to find ourselves. We fixate on Spider-Man, not Mary Jane, on Superman, not Lois Lane. Hell, even the Swamp Thing held more fantasy appeal than his girlfriend, whose name I can't even remember. Sure, he had green algae dangling from his nose and looked like the kind of thing you could pull up out of a clogged drain, but boy, could he kick some bad guy butt. And that was very important to a little girl. I have an excerpt from a short story by my friend and colleague Kelly Link, who I think is one of the most brilliant short story writers I know, who talks about these images of what is suitable for womanhood. The short story is called "Most of My Friends Are Two-Thirds of Water." Jack keeps a journal in which he records the dreams he has about making love to his ex-girlfriend Nikki, who looks like Sandy Duncan. Nikki is now married to someone else. In the most recent dream, Jack says, Nikki had a wooden leg. Sandy Duncan has a glass eye in real life. Jack calls me up to tell me this dream. He calls to say that he's in love with the woman who does the Braun coffee maker commercial, the one with the short blonde hair like Nikki and eyes that are dreamy and a little too far apart. He can't tell from the commercial if she has a wooden leg, but he watches TV every night in hopes of seeing her again. If I were blonde, I could fall in love with Jack. Jack calls me with the first line of a story. "Most of my friends are two-thirds water," he says, and I say that this doesn't surprise me. He says, no, that this is the first line. There's a Philip K. Dick novel, I tell him, that has a first line like that, but not exactly, and I can't remember the name of the novel. I'm listening to him while I clean out my father's refrigerator. The name of the Philip K. Dick novel is Confessions of a Crap Artist, I tell Jack. What novel? He says. He says that he followed a woman home from the subway accidentally. He says that he was sitting across from her on the number one uptown and he smiled at her. This is a bad thing to do in New York when there isn't anyone else in the subway car traveling uptown past 116th Street when it's 1 o'clock in the morning, even when you're Asian and not much taller than she is, even when she made eye contact first, which is what Jack says she did. Anyway, he smiled and she looked away. He got off at the next stop, 125th. She got off at the next stop, 125th, and so did he. 125th is his stop. She looked back when she saw him. Her face changed and he began to walk faster. Was she blonde? I asked casually. I don't remember, Jack says. What happens in this story is, or it may or may not be happening, you're never sure because Kelly is that kind of writer. Women start appearing who are perfect and blonde, and the men around her start falling in love with them around the character, and she's trying to convince them that, you know, Barbies are taking over the world. And you never, ever really know if this is actually true. I suspect when it comes to science fiction, comics, all of those things, those icons of popular literature, we've all done this in one way or another, gone digging through the images of appropriate personhood with which we're presented, images which often exclude us completely, and looked for the clues that, yes, people like us do in fact exist, can be seen as valuable, strong, sexy, and beautiful. For me, I've often been doing it in complete isolation as a matter of faith. If one of me exists, then, unlikely as my experience of the world tells me it is, there must be others, mustn't there? There must be people who find chunky women's bodies beautiful, mustn't there? After all, chunky women keep having kids, so someone must be joining us in that endeavor. There must be more bookaholic tomboy girls who climb trees with books clenched in their teeth so that they have something to do when they get up there. There must be more freaky people who find blue lipstick more interesting than the ubiquitous shades of red, who find sexy Annie Lennox even sexier when she's in Elvis drag, and the cave troll more appealing than the exiled prince. I can't be the only person in the world who finds Marilyn Manson hot, can I? Oh, good, someone agrees with me. Last time I said this, the whole room of 500 people all went. And if people like me and you exist, our lives must be just as worth telling stories about, right? Perhaps the stories just get buried and don't make it into the mainstream, for all the reasons that I probably don't need to break down to this crowd of people. But you eventually figure out that those stories don't get hidden entirely. You learn that people like you are out there. You just have to look. You learn to apply a different filter to the messages that the world gives you. You learn to look for clues. It's kind of like figuring out a bunch of hanky codes. I'm going to bring that to a close with one last quotation, speaking of hanky codes, from the Rethu novels by Storm Constantine. They were all gathered together into one volume, but originally there were three different volumes. The titles were The Enchantments of Flesh and Spirit, The Bewitchments of Love and Hate, and The Fulfillments of Fate and Desire. This section is from the very beginning of the first novel, where the protagonist meets the people who will change his life. How do you feel about women? He asked abruptly. I know what it means to be Rethu, I murmured, hoping that would suffice. Answer, he demanded, and I was afraid that Teres would wake. I've never known them, I sputtered quickly. I never think about things like that, never. It doesn't matter. Inside, nothing. It doesn't matter. I struggled in his hold. It will, he said quietly, relaxing his grip on me. But not yet, and certainly not here. You will be Rethu. Perhaps you always have been waiting here at the end of the world. You've just been asleep, that's all, but you will wake one day. We lay in silence for a while, listening to Therese rattling away on the bed. For the first time, I opened my eyes and looked at Cal. He noticed and smiled at me. I did not feel strange lying there with him. He was like an old friend. For now, he said, I shall give you something very special. It is a rare thing among us and not given lightly. You will learn its significance as time goes on. I'm doing it because you fascinate me, because there's something important inside you. I don't know what it is yet, but I know it was no accident I found you. He leant on his elbow over me. This is called the sharing of breath. It is sacred and powerful. I was nearly sick with fright as his face loomed above me, satanic with shadows. I closed my eyes and felt his breath upon me. I expected a vast vampiric drain on my lungs, pain of some kind. I felt his lips dry and firm touch my own. His tongue like a thread of fire touched my teeth. He called it a sharing of breath. My arms curled around his back, which was hardened with stress and muscle. He called it a sharing of breath. Where I come from, we called it a kiss. Thank you.